Imagine you are at a baseball game.
Okay, I'm there.
Right. And the pitcher winds up and throws like this 95 mile per hour fastball.
Yeah.
While that ball is in the air, zooming toward home plate, you know intuitively that it has a specific speed.
Right.
Like, you know it has a specific location at every single microsecond of its flight. Even if you closed your eyes, or I don't know, even if the radar gun in the stadium just suddenly lost power and broke, you wouldn't doubt for a single second that the baseball is still moving. It's
Exact.
still possessing its mass, its speed, its trajectory, because, well, it is a physical object moving through a physical universe.
It's the most natural assumption in the world. I
Yeah.
mean, we are biologically hardwired to think that way.
Right. But now I want you to shrink that baseball down. Imagine an electron zooming through space. You'd probably assume the exact same thing, wouldn't you?
You would.
Yeah.
Most people definitely do.
Yeah, even if we don't have the microscopic tools to measure it, or even if all the scientists in the room are looking the other way, that electron must be going a certain speed. But according to one of the most ambitious physicists alive today, your intuition, and frankly, the intuition of classical physics for centuries, is entirely wrong.
Completely wrong.
That electron doesn't have an unknown speed. It has no speed at all, at least not until it interacts with something else.
Which is, to put it mildly, an incredibly uncomfortable pill to swallow.
Oh, absolutely.
Because we are so deeply conditioned, like going all the way back to Aristotle and Newton, to think of the universe as a giant container. And inside this container, you have objects.
Right. Nouns.
Yeah, exactly, nouns. And those objects possess inherent absolute properties. Mass, speed, location, spin. We think the properties are baked into the objects themselves, but modern physics is forcing this massive paradigm shift that suggests the exact opposite.
And that is exactly what we're going to try to wrap our heads around today. We are taking a deep dive into a profoundly fascinating 2026 paper by C.F. Deitz.
It really is a brilliant paper.
It is. It's titled The Grammar of Relations. And what Deitz has done here is he takes the cutting-edge physics of Carlo Rovelli, and you might know Rovelli for his groundbreaking work on quantum gravity, or his incredibly popular books like Seven Brief Lessons on
Or
Physics.
the order of time. That's another huge one.
Yes, the order of time, exactly. So Deitz merges Rovelli's physics with his own philosophical architecture, which he calls the closure framework.
Which is such a rare and exciting synthesis, really, because usually physicists and philosophers, they just stay in their own departments and occasionally throw chalk at each other across the quad, right?
Yeah, they do not mix.
They don't. But what is so compelling about this specific paper is that it takes two completely different disciplines. The hard mathematical world of quantum physics on one side, and the abstract world of epistemology and philosophy of mind on the other, and shows how they have independently arrived at the exact same structural truth about reality.
Which is just mind-blowing.
It is. They started at opposite ends of the intellectual universe, dug downwards, and somehow hit the exact same center.
So our goal for this conversation is to take you, the listener, on a journey to the absolute bottom of reality. We are going to explore how modern physics and philosophy are converging on a single, frankly, mind-bending idea. And that idea is that the universe isn't made of things that have absolute properties. It is made entirely of relationships.
Yeah.
By the time we finish this deep dive, you're going to understand why time doesn't fundamentally flow, why the idea of an objective observer is an actual physical impossibility, and most importantly, what all of this means for you as a conscious being just trying to navigate your daily life.
Because it forces a total recalibration of what we mean when we say something is real.
Okay, so I want to go back to that electron I mentioned in the intro because I feel like that is where the trouble really starts. Let's unpack Carlo Rovelli's theory. It's called relational quantum mechanics, or RQM, and he's been painstakingly developing it since, what, about 1996?
Really,
Yeah. So to understand why Rovelli had to invent this, we really need to understand the mess he was trying to clean up, right?
absolutely. We have to look at how physicists have traditionally dealt with quantum mechanics for like the last 100 years. And just to be clear up front, mathematically, quantum mechanics is the most successful scientific theory in human history.
Yeah.
I mean, it gave us lasers, microchips, MRI machines. The math works perfectly. But philosophically,
Yeah.
conceptually, it has been a total nightmare since the 1920s.
Because, well, the equations don't describe the world the way we actually experience it, do they?
Exactly. They don't at all. The famous Schrödinger equation, it describes particles as being in multiple possible states at once, which is what we call a superposition.
Right.
So if you have an electron, The math says it isn't strictly here or there. It is a smear of probabilities. It has the potential to be in many places, or, you know, spinning in different directions simultaneously.
Yeah.
But when we actually look at it, when we measure it, we never see a smear. We see a single solid point. We see a definite reality.
Right. And this is where the traditional mainstream interpretation comes in, the Copenhagen interpretation.
Yeah.
Spearheaded by Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg back in the day. So how did they explain that jump from, like, a fuzzy cloud of math to a solid point of reality?
Well, they essentially said that the act of measurement magically collapses the wave function.
Magically collapses it?
Basically, yeah. This superposition, this cloud of possibilities, exists right up until the exact moment a scientist in a lab coat looks at the dial on their measuring machine. And the moment of observation forces the universe to make a choice. The fuzzy cloud collapses into a single definite reality.
I have to admit, I mean, even as someone who loves reading about this stuff, the Copenhagen interpretation has always felt like a massive cop-out to me.
You're not alone in that.
It just feels like sweeping the biggest mystery in the universe under the rug of the word measurement. Like, what on earth even counts as a measurement? Does it need to be a conscious human with a clipboard? What if a dog looks at the experiment? What if a fly lands on the detector? Does the universe collapse then?
You've just hit on the exact absurdity that has driven physicists crazy for a century. It's known as the measurement problem.
Yeah.
And there is a very famous thought experiment called Wigner's Friend that beautifully highlights how broken this idea of an objective collapse really is.
Oh, I've heard of this one, but walk me through it. How does the Wigner's Friend thing work?
Okay, so imagine Eugene Wigner, who is a famous physicist, puts his friend inside a completely sealed, perfectly isolated laboratory.
Okay, like a vault.
Yeah, exactly like a vault. No information can get in or out. Inside that lab, the friend conducts a quantum experiment. Let's say he measures our famous electron to see if it's spinning up or down.
Got it.
According to the friend inside the lab, he makes the measurement, the wave function collapses, and he gets a definite result. He writes down, you know, the electron is spinning up.
Makes sense so far. I mean, the friend did a measurement, so the reality collapsed for him.
Right. But now, let's look at it from the perspective of Eugene Wigner, who is standing outside the sealed laboratory. Wigner cannot see inside.
Right.
From Wigner's mathematical perspective, his friend, the measuring device, and the electron are all just one giant quantum system.
Because he hasn't looked yet.
Exactly. Because Wigner hasn't interacted with the lab yet, the math dictates that the entire lab, including the friend and the result he wrote down, is in a state of superposition. For Wigner, his friend is simultaneously in a state of having measured up and having measured down.
Wait, so for the friend inside, a hard physical fact has already happened. Like, the universe has collapsed into a single reality.
Yep.
But for the guy standing outside the door, that collapse hasn't happened yet.
Right.
The friend is basically a giant Schrödinger's cat.
Exactly. That's exactly it. So who is right? Does the universe collapse when the friend looks at the electron?
Yeah.
Or does it collapse when Wigner opens the door to the lab and asks his friend what happened?
That's a huge problem.
It is. The traditional interpretations of quantum mechanics just break down here.
Mm-hmm.
Because they imply there is some absolute objective state of the universe.
Yeah.
And we just have to figure out whose observation, you know, counts the most.
And this is where Carlo Rovelli steps in and just flips the game board over completely.
He really does. Rovelli decided to take the math of quantum mechanics literally without adding any magical universe-wide collapse mechanisms.
Okay.
He realized that the paradox of Wigner's friend isn't a paradox at all if you just stop assuming that properties are absolute. In relational quantum mechanics, Rovelli argues that properties like the speed, position, or spin of our hypothetical electron do not belong to the object independently.
Right.
They are strictly 100% produced during an interaction between systems.
Let me stop you there because the language here is tricky and I want to make sure I'm getting this. When you say produce during an interaction, you don't just mean revealed, right? Like, you mean they literally do not exist prior to the handshake.
I mean, they literally do not exist, period. Before the interaction, the property isn't hiding in some metaphysical closet waiting to be discovered. It simply does not exist.
Wow.
And after the interaction, it exists only relative to the specific system it interacted with. This is the crucial part that actually solves Wigner's friend.
Okay, let's map Rovelli's idea back onto the Wigner scenario then, just to see how it works in practice.
Sure. So inside the lab, the electron interacts with the friend's measuring device. Boom, an interaction happens.
Yeah.
Therefore, a relational fact is produced. The electron is now spinning up relative to the friend. But Wigner, standing outside the door, has not yet interacted with the electron, or with his friend, or with the lab.
So from Wigner's perspective, what is happening?
From Wigner's perspective, the definite fact the electron spin has not been produced. From his perspective, the friend and the electron are still entangled in a superposition of possibilities. And here's the kicker, like the absolute core of Rovelli's theory. Both realities are physically correct.
That is just, it's wild. So relative to the friend inside, there is a hard physical fact. Relative to Wigner outside, there is no fact yet. Just a cloud of probabilities. And neither one of them is wrong or hallucinating.
Exactly. The math says they are both perfectly describing reality, because reality itself is strictly relative to the observer.
I see.
What's fascinating here is that this is not a failure of our measuring tools. It's not some artifact of quantum uncertainty where we just need a better microscope to see what's really going on.
Yeah.
Rovelli is asserting that this is the actual fundamental structure of physical reality.
Hmm.
The facts themselves are relational.
You know, it's funny, trying to wrap my head around this, it actually reminds me of an experience I had traveling a few years ago.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I was in Japan, and I was sitting in a bar, and I tried to tell a joke to a guy sitting next to me, and, you know, I translated it in my head, I delivered it with perfect time, oh, at least I thought I did.
Yeah.
And nothing. Just a polite, incredibly confused blink. It was brutal.
The universal language of bombing a joke.
Exactly. But it made me realize something about humor. Like, a joke doesn't possess the absolute physical property of being funny, just floating out there in a void. A joke is really just a series of sound waves.
Right.
It only becomes funny in the exact moment of interaction with a specific mind that understands the punchline, that shares the cultural context, that speaks the language fluently. Relative to the guy in the bar in Tokyo, the humor simply didn't exist.
Yeah.
It's not that the humor was hidden beneath the table. It literally wasn't there for him. And it sounds like what Rovelli's saying is that the entire physical universe, stuff like mass, speed, and location, works exactly like that joke.
That is a remarkably precise analogy. The humor is constituted strictly in the interaction. It is a relational property. And if we connect this to the bigger picture of, you know, the history of physics, it's actually very similar to what Albert Einstein did with time and space.
Right. Einstein's relativity of simultaneity.
Yes. Let's look at 1905, just before Einstein published his special theory of relativity.
Mm.
Physicists back then assumed that time was an absolute backdrop, like a universal ticking clock.
Yeah.
If two lightning bolts struck two different train stations, they either struck at the exact same time or they didn't. It was an absolute objective fact of the universe.
Which seems like common sense. I mean, either things happen at the same time or they don't.
Right. But Einstein came along and proved mathematically that common sense was wrong. He proved that simultaneity depends entirely on your frame of reference.
Okay, explain that.
Well, imagine you're standing still on the platform exactly halfway between the two stations and the lightning strikes. The light reaches your eyes at the exact same moment. So you say, they struck simultaneously.
Sure.
But imagine I am on a high-speed train moving toward the north station when the lightning strikes. Because I am moving toward the north flash and away from the south flash, the light from the north hits my eyes first. I say, no, the north station was struck first.
And before Einstein, people would just say, well, one of you is experiencing an optical illusion. Let's find the true absolute time.
Exactly. But Einstein proved there is no true absolute time. You are right relative to the platform. I am right relative to the train. And neither perspective is the absolute truth, because absolute time simply does not exist. The simultaneity is relational.
So Rovelli is basically taking that exact same intellectual leap, but instead of just applying it to time and space, he's applying it to the very existence of physical properties themselves.
Precisely. Einstein said when things happen is relational. Rovelli is saying what things are is relational.
Wow.
The quantum state of a system isn't an absolute feature of that system. It is a description of that system relative to another specific system.
It's completely staggering. But I think it's important to pause here and ask, you know, why should someone listening to this deep dive on their commute or while washing the dishes care about the relational speed of an electron?
That's a fair question.
Because I think when you really internalize this, it fundamentally forces you to rethink what you mean when you say something in your life is real. We grew up thinking reality is a stage filled with props.
Right.
The trees, the cars, the buildings, they are just sitting there, existing independently, whether we interact with them or not. But this deep dive tells us reality isn't a stage filled with independent props. It's an endless, ongoing web of handshakes. Everything that is real is real relative to something else.
And that leads to a profound shift in ontology. Ontology being, you know, just the philosophical study of being of what actually exists.
Right.
Because if properties only exist during interactions, it begs a massive unavoidable question.
Which is, if the universe isn't made of independent things with permanent properties,
yeah,
what the hell is it actually made of?
Which brings us to Rovelli's second major claim outlined in Dietz's paper, event ontology. Rovelli argues that the world is a world of interactions, not things.
So we are essentially moving from a universe made of nouns to a universe made of verbs.
That's a beautiful way to put it, actually. Let's contrast it with the old view. If you go back to the ancient Greeks, to Democritus, the idea was that the universe is made of tiny, uncuttable, solid blocks called atoms. Reality is made of stuff. Nouns.
Yeah, little Lego bricks.
Exactly. But modern quantum field theory has completely obliterated that idea. There are no tiny, solid billiard balls at the bottom of reality. There are just fields of energy.
So how do we get from, like, fields of energy to the solid chair I'm sitting in right now?
Through events, Rovelli argues that the world is made of temporary interactions that produce relational facts and then immediately dissolve. Think of it like a conversation or, say, a kiss.
A kiss, okay.
Yeah, a kiss isn't an object you can put in a box and store in your closet. It's an event. It occurs between participants, generating a specific exchange of energy and information. And when the participants pull away, the kiss doesn't go hide somewhere waiting to come out again. It simply ceases to be.
It was an event that existed purely in the relation.
Exactly. Rovelli says the fundamental building blocks of reality are like that kiss. Between these interactions, physical systems do not possess definite properties. They sit in a state of relational indeterminacy. They are just mathematical potential waiting for the next handshake.
And this event ontology, that's what actually dissolves the Wigner's friend paradox we talked about earlier.
It dissolves it elegantly.
Yeah.
The measurement problem asks how a magical, universe-wide collapse of the quantum state happens. How does reality instantly snap into focus everywhere all at once?
Right.
And Rovelli says there is no universe-wide collapse. There is no magical global event. What we call a collapse is just the localized production of a relational fact between the quantum system and the measuring device.
It's just a local handshake. So the universe didn't suddenly snap into a single focus for everyone everywhere. The spin of the electron just snapped into focus for that one specific friend inside that one specific lab.
It's a temporary localized event. There is no mysterious objective collapse because there was never an absolute objective state to begin with.
I see.
And as Dietz points out in his paper, replacing things with events does something monumental for physics as a whole. It builds a bridge between the tiny microscopic world of quantum mechanics and the large macroscopic world of thermodynamics.
How so? Walk me through that connection, because that sounds like a big leap.
It is, but it makes sense. When you build your physics on things, on tiny solid nouns, you have an incredibly hard time explaining how the weird, fuzzy, indeterminate quantum nouns somehow stack up to make the solid, predictable, macroscopic nouns we deal with every day.
The math of the tiny doesn't play nicely with the math of the large.
Exactly. But if the universe is fundamentally made of events, then the math changes. You aren't trying to track persistent objects anymore. You are tracking the sequence of events and the exchange of information that systems share with each other during those interactions. And thermodynamics is basically just the science of how information and energy shuffle around in large systems.
Okay, I am following you, but I have a major problem here.
Go for it.
I need to play the skeptic for a second because I can hear the listener shouting at their phone right now.
Fair enough.
If the world is just a flashing sequence of temporary events and there are new persistent things at the bottom of reality, why does my physical environment feel so incredibly persistent? Like I am leaning my forearms on a wooden desk right now. It feels extremely solid. It feels like a noun. Tell my bruised elbows that this desk is just a sequence of temporary kisses.
Right.
If I turn my head away, my coffee cup doesn't dissolve into a cloud of probability. It's still exactly where I left it when I look back. If everything is relational and temporary, how does anything persist through time?
That is the ultimate pushback. It is the exact question that almost breaks relational theories if you don't have the right philosophical tools.
Okay.
Rovelli's physics is brilliant. The math proves that the world is relational. But physics alone struggles to answer your question about the coffee cup. To understand why and how these interactions are governed so that macroscopic objects seem so stubbornly solid and stable, we need a different framework.
And that is exactly where C.F. Dietz enters the chat. We need Dietz to explain the coffee cup.
Yes, we do.
This brings us to the core of Dietz's work, the closure framework, which really gives us the why behind Rivelli's physics.
Right. So C.F. Dietz is a philosopher who recently published a massive work called Consciousness, Closure, and the Cosmos. In this 2026 paper we are discussing, Dietz argues something remarkable. He argues that Rovelli found the relational structure of facts by digging through the equations of quantum mechanics, while Dietz found the exact same structural grammar by digging through epistemology and the philosophy of mind.
Epistemology being the study of how we know what we know. So we basically have two completely different languages describing the exact same territory.
Yes.
Let's break down Dietz's core concept then. What exactly is a closure regime? Because honestly, the name sounds a bit intimidating.
It sounds like a dystopian government, I know. But it's actually a very elegant concept. In Dietz's philosophy, a closure regime is any system that stabilizes content by doing three things. Mm-hmm. It draws distinctions, establishes identity criteria, and maintains lawful relationships among its parts.
Okay, that's a bit abstract. I need an analogy here. Let's stick with the government idea for a second. Think of a country, let's say France.
Right.
France isn't a solid physical object. You can't pick up France and put it in your pocket. France is a closure regime. First, it establishes a border. It draws a distinction between what is inside France and what is outside.
Right.
Second, it has identity criteria. It has a constitution and laws that dictate exactly what makes one a French citizen versus just a tourist.
Mm-hmm.
And third, it maintains internal relationships like a tax system, a government, an economy.
That's a fantastic macroscopic example. And Dietz argues that these closure regimes literally constitute facts within their scope. The facts of who is a citizen or what the currency is worth do not exist absolutely in nature. They only exist and are only true relative to the closure regime of France.
Right. Because if the regime collapses, the facts dissolve. The euro in your pocket just becomes a meaningless piece of metal.
Exactly. Now, Dietz takes that concept and applies it to the fundamental physics we've been talking about. Dietz says that Rovelli's observing system, the measuring machine in Wigner's lab that interacts with the electron to give it a definite spin, that machine is a closure regime.
But how does a machine have identity criteria?
Because it is physically organized in a highly specific way. A machine designed to measure electron spin has a distinct physical boundary. It has internal components configured to react only to magnetic moments. Those physical configurations are its identity criteria.
Oh, I see.
So the quantum state of a system isn't just abstract math floating in a void. Dietz says it is a literal description of a closure's relational potential. It describes the specific set of interactions that a given closure regime can enter into based on its unique identity criteria.
So, addressing my pushback about the solid wooden desk and the coffee cup directly, the reason a biological cell or a coffee cup or my own physical body persists isn't because it's made of permanent, unchanging stuff.
Not at all. If you get a powerful enough electron microscope and look closely at your coffee cup or your own hand, you will see that every single atomic component is constantly moving, vibrating, interacting, and being swapped out.
Yeah, constantly in motion.
In your biological body alone, cells are dying and being replaced by the millions every single second. The carbon atoms in your skin today were literally not there a few years ago.
It's the classic Ship of Theseus paradox. Like, if you replace every plank of wood on a ship over a 10-year voyage, is it still the same ship when it returns to port?
Right. And Dietz's answer is, yes, it is the same ship, because the ship isn't the wood. The ship is the closure regime. Your coffee cup and your body persist because their organizational closure, the identity criteria, the macroscopic structure, the pattern of how the parts relate to each other, persists across an ongoing chaotic sequence of lower-level relational events. The underlying atomic parts are just a flashing sequence of interactions, but the pattern of closure actively maintains itself.
Okay, but my coffee cup isn't actively doing anything. It's just sitting there. I'm the one looking at it.
Which brings in Dietz's concept of nested closure to explain this perfectly. We have to remember that the universe is a hierarchy. The reason the chaotic, flashing, indeterminate quantum world looks so stable, solid, and classical to us is because we exist at a massively higher level of nested closure.
Meaning we were built out of billions of smaller closures, all stacked together.
Yes. And because we are so massive and complex, we aren't capable of experiencing individual quantum events. When you look at your coffee cup, your visual cortex isn't processing the quadrillions of individual quantum handshakes happening on the ceramic surface.
It would be too much.
Way too much. Your closure regime is designed to integrate or summarize, billions of tiny lower-level relational facts into coarser, more stable macroscopic facts. You don't see atoms. You see white, solid cylinder.
We are biological summarizers. We compress the data.
Exactly. So what Deitz is saying is that a system without these identity criteria, without closure, literally couldn't interact with the universe in a meaningful way.
Because there would be no it for a fact to be relative to. I love this part. If you don't have identity criteria, you can't participate in an event that produces a specific kind of fact. For example, a thermometer can interact with the air in my living room to produce a relational fact about the temperature. Why? Because the thermometer is a closure regime with physical identity criteria, liquid mercury in a glass tube, specifically designed to expand in response to kinetic energy.
Spot on.
A rock sitting next to the thermometer doesn't have those specific criteria, so it doesn't constitute a temperature fact in the exact same refined, measurable way the thermometer does, even though the rock still has its own basic physical closure.
It is genuinely profound that a physicist like Ravelli, staring at the most fundamental equations of matter and probability, and a philosopher like Dietz, looking at how biological minds create meaning, arrived at the exact same conclusion independently.
It really is.
Facts are constituted within relations, governed by the organizational structure of the systems involved.
But wait, if my brain and my body are constantly summarizing the universe, if I'm integrating quadrillions of quantum handshakes into simple concepts like desk and coffee cup, that means I'm ignoring a massive amount of data.
You are ignoring almost all of it. If you are a macroscopic closure regime interacting with the world, you can't possibly process every single microscopic quantum detail of the environment you're interacting with. Your brain would instantly fry. It's far too much information.
You leave things out. You have to. You're blind to the absolute bottom of reality.
You are. And this exact blind spot, this inevitable structural gap in what you can process, is not just a glitch in the matrix. It is the exact mechanism that creates one of the most fundamental, inescapable, and emotional experiences of your entire life.
And this leads us perfectly into the mystery of time.
Yes.
Because if properties only exist in relationships, what about the flow of time? Does time exist out there in the void?
This is where Ravelli's work gets incredibly poetic, but I want to stress that it is entirely grounded in hard thermodynamics. Ravelli proposed what he calls the thermal time hypothesis, and to really grasp how wild this is, we have to start with a very unintuitive fact about physics.
Okay, hit me.
The fundamental equations of nature are completely time symmetric.
Time symmetric, meaning they work identically forwards and backwards.
Exactly. If you look at Newton's laws of motion or the equations for quantum mechanics and you plug the numbers in reverse, the math works perfectly.
Right.
Let's use a tangible example. Imagine I show you a video of two billiard balls rolling across a green table and bouncing off each other. Then I play the video in reverse. The reverse video looks entirely normal. The balls bounce off each other and roll away. There is nothing in the foundational equations of physics that says time must move forward. At the microscopic level, the universe has no preference for the future over the past.
There is no fundamental arrow of time in nature at the deepest level. But that makes no sense to my human experience.
I know.
If you show me a video of a glass shattering on the kitchen floor, and then you play it in reverse, I immediately know it's being played backwards. Shards of glass don't magically jump off the floor and reassemble into a perfect cup.
Right, so this raises one of the biggest questions in science. If the deepest math of the universe doesn't care about time, where does time come from? Why do we remember the past but not the future? Why do things age? Why do glasses shatter but never unshatter?
And Ravelli's answer is almost insulting to our egos. He says that time emerges purely from our epistemic ignorance.
Yes.
Which is just a fancy academic way of saying time exists because we are really, really bad at seeing the universe's microscopic details.
To understand how ignorance creates time, we have to talk about entropy.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to spend a minute here because entropy is a word that gets thrown around a lot, usually just meaning chaos or decay. But it's actually a very specific statistical concept pioneered by a physicist named Ludwig Boltzmann in the 19th century.
Let's do it. Explain entropy to me like I'm five, but, you know, keep the math intact.
Okay. Imagine a glass of pure, clear water. I take an eyedropper and put one single drop of dense red dye perfectly in the center of the glass. In that initial moment, the system has very low entropy. It is highly ordered. You have tight cluster of red dye molecules in the middle and clear water everywhere else.
Okay, I picture it.
Now, we know what happens next.
Ah.
Over the next hour, the red dye will slowly spread out, diffusing through the water until the entire glass is a uniform pale pink. This state, the pale pink state, is high entropy. It is a messy equilibrium. Now, why does it spread out? It's not because there is a magical force pushing the dye apart. It's purely because of statistics.
Because there are vastly more ways for the dye to be mixed up than for it to be clumped together.
Exactly. Think of all the individual molecules. Mm-hmm. There are trillions of ways those molecules can bounce around and still look like a uniform pink blur to our human eyes. We call that the macroscopic state. But there are very, very few specific microscopic arrangements that look like a perfect tight drop of red dye in the center. So as the molecules randomly bump into each other, the laws of probability dictate that the system will naturally wander into the more common state. It will inevitably evolve from low entropy, the ordered drop, to high entropy, the pink blur, simply because there are infinitely more ways to be a pink blur.
Okay, I follow the statistics, it's just probability. But how does this create time?
That statistical slide, the inevitable movement from a rare ordered state to a common messy state, is the arrow of time. That's why the glass shatters and doesn't unshatter. But, and here is Ravelli's absolute genius, that entropy, that movement, only exists because we are observing a macroscopic coarse-grained summary of the water glass. We are looking at the pink blur.
We see the big picture, not the pixels.
Right. If you were a microscopic demon and you could perfectly see and track the momentum and position of every single water and dye molecule bouncing off each other, you wouldn't see entropy increasing. You would just see billions of individual, time-symmetric billiard ball collisions.
Because at that level, the math is symmetric.
Yes. The math of the collisions works forwards and backwards. For the microscopic demon, there is no blur, no coarse graining, and fundamentally, no irreversible flow of time.
Let me make sure I'm fully grasping the weight of this. Are you saying that time is not a physical property of the universe? It is an optical illusion created by our blurry vision?
Ravelli is saying that thermal time is an emergent property. It's like the wetness of water.
Okay.
A single H2O molecule is not wet. Wetness only emerges when you have billions of them interacting with your nervous system. In the same way, a single quantum interaction does not have time. The flow of time only emerges when a coarse-graining observer interacts with billions of quantum events and blurs them together.
Okay, let's tie this profound physics realization back to Dietz's philosophy, because Dekker's concept of the remainder fits this like a glove.
It does.
Dietz says that a closure regime like my biological brain cannot possibly model all the microscopic details of the universe. I'm not the microscopic demon. I have limited cognitive bandwidth. So, the stuff that falls outside my modeling capacity, the infinite microscopic details that I miss, Dietz formally calls the remainder.
And Dietz's framework gives us the exact philosophical mechanism for Ravelli's physics. The entropy differential that generates the arrow of time is simply the thermodynamic expression of Dietz's remainder. The universe has infinite detail. You have finite capacity. The friction between those two things generates your experience of time.
This actually makes a lot of intuitive sense if you think about how our perception of time changes in real life.
Oh, definitely.
Think about your own life listening to this. If you go to the gym and you hold a plank position for 2 minutes, it feels like an hour. You are painfully hyper-focused on the physical sensations. You are modeling a lot of immediate stressful data. Your biological closure is working on overdrive.
Right, you're tracking every second.
But if you are on a 2-week vacation in Hawaii, having the time of your life, the days blur together, and 2 weeks feels like a weekend. When your brain coarse grains the days because you are relaxed and not tracking the minutiae, time accelerates.
That's a great psychological parallel.
Mm.
Dietz views the inexhaustible ground of reality, all those infinite microscopic quantum details, which he calls M, as fully real. The universe really is doing all that flashing and interacting. We just can't process it all. So for Dietz, thermal time is the actual lived temporal experience of a finite closure regime encountering this inexhaustible remainder it cannot model.
Think about the emotional weight of this. We spend our whole lives feeling that time is an unstoppable objective river carrying us toward our death. It pushes us forward, it breaks our toys, it ages ourselves. It feels like an external tyrant.
Yeah.
But this text suggests time is just the structural friction of our own existence. Time is what happens when your finite mind meets the infinite universe. If you somehow had an infinite capacity to model every atom in your body and your environment perfectly, the flow of time as a distinct irreversible arrow would vanish into the time-symmetric math of the cosmos.
It is the temporal structure that emerges when finite organization meets the infinite. The time that flows for you is generated strictly by the gap between what you can constitute as a fact and what exceeds your capacity.
It's incredibly beautiful and, to be honest, a little terrifying.
It is a bit unsettling, yeah.
It completely destabilizes everything I thought I knew about my reality, which actually acts as the perfect transition to the next massive implication of this paper.
Where are we heading?
Well, if every fact is only relative to a specific observer, and even time itself is just a byproduct of our limited, coarse-grained perspective, is there any objective God's eye view of reality left?
Ah, and that takes us to the philosophical peak of the mountain. The end of the view from nowhere.
The view from nowhere is such a great phrase. It originally comes from the philosopher Thomas Nagel, right?
Yes, it does.
It's this deep-seated human desire to step outside the universe, to completely detach ourselves from our messy, limited biological bodies, float above the cosmos, and just look down at the absolute objective truth of everything all at once, like the master spreadsheet of reality.
It's the ultimate goal of the Enlightenment, really.
Okay.
The belief that with enough science and enough math, we could eventually map reality perfectly without our own messy perspectives getting in the way. But this is Rovelli's fourth and arguably most philosophically radical claim in his physics. He argues that the concept of an absolute perspective independent description of the world isn't just hard to achieve because our telescopes aren't big enough. He argues it is logically incoherent.
The universe does not have an absolute state.
It does not. It is a vast, infinitely interconnected network of partial, perspectival descriptions. Every description is relative to something. There's no master spreadsheet in the sky.
Now, I need to push back here, or at least play defense for a second, just we need to be really careful. When people hear a scientist say everything is relative, or there is no absolute truth, they immediately jump to philosophical relativism or postmodernism.
Right, the idea that there are no facts, or my truth is just as valid as your truth, or that reality is just a social construct.
Exactly. I can hear the listener saying, wait, if everything is relative, what about gravity? If I jump off a building, I'm going to hit the ground. That's an absolute fact. What about 2 + 2 = 4? Are you telling me that's just a perspective?
That is an absolutely critical distinction to make, and it's why Rovelli's physics is so rigorous. He is not advocating for post-truth relativism. We have to separate abstract logic, like math, from the physical state of matter. Yes, 2 + 2 = 4 is a logical absolute.
Right.
But when we are talking about the physical state of the universe, where things are, how fast they are moving, what state they are in, relational facts are 100% real physical facts. They are just real within that relation.
If a car is coming at you at 60 miles per hour relative to your body, that is a very real, very hard physical fact that will have devastating, bone-crushing consequences if you don't move out of the way. It's not imaginary. It's not a social construct.
Exactly. The fact of the car's speed is absolute for you in that interaction.
Yeah.
If you and a friend both measure the same car, you can agree on its speed. Science still works perfectly. We can share information and build a consensus reality based on our shared relational interactions.
Yeah.
But the underlying grammar of the universe, the foundational structure of how physical reality works, does not permit a description of the car that isn't tied to an observer.
We can map this directly to Dietz's philosophy to see why the God's eye view is impossible. Dietz established that any finite closure regime generates a remainder. It has to leave something out because it doesn't have the capacity to model the infinite details.
Right.
Therefore, logic dictates that to have a view from nowhere, a perfect absolute view of reality with zero blind spots, you would need an infinite closure. A system that perfectly models everything in the universe simultaneously, generating zero remainder.
And here is the fatal flaw in the Enlightenment dream. In the physical world, infinite closures do not exist. It's a physical paradox.
It's like the old paradox of the map and the territory, right? The writer Jorge Luis Borges had a great short story about an empire that wanted a map so perfectly detailed that it matched the empire exactly.
Yes. But to make a map that perfect, the map has to be the exact same size as the territory.
Yeah.
And furthermore, since the map is now inside the territory, the map has to include a perfect, detailed map of itself.
Which has to include a map of itself ad infinitum. It's an infinite regress.
You can't have a system perfectly model the universe, because the system is part of the universe. It would have to model its own modeling process perfectly.
Precisely. Therefore, a view from nowhere is structurally and physically impossible. It goes against the very grain of how facts are constituted. You cannot step outside the universe to look at it because there is no outside.
There is no outside.
This raises a massive shift in how we should think about science. If there is no view from nowhere, then science itself isn't what we were taught in high school. It isn't a process of discovering absolute detached truths floating out in the void waiting to be plucked. Science is a process of discovering how we, as specific physical biological systems, uniquely relate to the rest of the cosmos. We aren't scientists looking at the universe through a clean glass window. We are in the mud. We are permanently tangled up in the data.
We are participants, not just spectators. Every observation we make, every experiment we run, is a relational event that produces a fact relative to us. We are the universe studying itself through the lens of human closure.
It is incredibly humbling. So, up to this point in the paper, Ravelli's quantum physics and Dietz's philosophy agree flawlessly. They are holding hands, walking down the path of relational reality.
They really are.
They agree on relational facts, event ontology, the emergence of thermal time, and the impossibility of the absolute view. But as Dietz explores in the final sections of his paper, there is one major place where the physicist and the philosopher fundamentally disagree.
And it is a fascinating, highly productive divergence, because it addresses the elephant in the room. It has everything to do with you, the listener, as a conscious being.
This is the crux of the whole thing, the productive divergence. What about consciousness? Because we've been talking about observers and measuring devices this whole time.
Right. And Carlo Rovelli takes a very strict, very defensive physicist stance when it comes to consciousness. He believes it has absolutely nothing to do with fundamental physics. He dismisses it entirely.
Interesting.
For Rovelli, consciousness is just a highly complex biological phenomenon, a messy emergent property for neuroscientists and biologists to figure out down the line. It's entirely separate from the foundations of quantum mechanics.
And to be fair to Rovelli, physicists have a very good reason to be defensive about the word consciousness. For the last 40 years, ever since quantum mechanics became popular, the New Age movement has totally hijacked the science.
Oh, absolutely. The quantum consciousness trope. The idea that human thoughts magically control reality.
Right, the Deepak Chopra stuff. The idea that if you just observe the universe with enough positive energy, you can manifest a parking spot or cure diseases because your mind is literally collapsing the quantum wave function with your desires. It drives physicists absolutely insane.
It does, because it completely misinterprets what an observer is in the math. When Rovelli says a relational observer creates a fact in an interaction, he means any physical system. A rock interacting with a photon of light is an observer.
A simple mercury thermometer is an observer.
Exactly. A single carbon atom bumping into a hydrogen atom is an observer. He actively wants to avoid any mystical implication that human consciousness is special or required for reality to exist.
And Dietz entirely agrees with Rovelli on that specific point, which is important to clarify. Dietz's closure framework does not argue that human consciousness causes quantum collapse.
No, not at all.
There are no magical human mind powers here. The moon is still there, even if a human isn't looking at it, because the moon is constantly interacting with the gravitational fields and photons of the rest of the solar system. The universe doesn't need us to exist.
Exactly. But, and this is where the divergence happens, Dietz does push back hard on Rovelli's total dismissal of consciousness as an irrelevant biological quirk. Dietz argues that while consciousness doesn't cause quantum events, the exact same structural mechanism that generates a relational fact at the quantum level is what generates conscious experience at the cognitive level.
Okay, we need to unpack this carefully because it gets at the hard problem of consciousness.
It does.
The philosopher David Chalmers famously coined the hard problem, which is, why does physical matter feel like anything? We can explain how the brain processes information, but why is there a subjective experience accompanying it? Why does red look red? Why does pain hurt?
Right. And Dietz believes the relational grammar of physics holds the key. Dietz is saying, look at the fundamental building blocks we just established. An electron speed is constituted. It becomes a reality because the measuring machine has specific identity criteria that make it capable of registering speed. The machine encounters the electron, and a physical fact is born in the relation.
Yes, the handshake.
Now scale that mechanism up drastically. Dietz says that the conscious experience of seeing the color red is constituted because a biological organism, you, the listener, is a highly complex nested closure regime. You have incredibly sophisticated identity criteria shaped by millions of years of biological evolution. Your retinas, your visual cortex, those criteria make color experience possible.
But wait, a digital camera has a lens and a sensor, and it registers red light. But a digital camera doesn't have a conscious experience of the color red. It just records data. What makes the human brain different? Why do I have a subjective experience, but the camera doesn't, if we are both just complex closure regimes interacting with light?
That's the million-dollar question. Dietz argues that consciousness isn't some magical ghost juice added to the physics of the brain. It is simply the felt interior of fact constitution for a system that is complex enough to model its own remainder.
The felt interior. That phrase is so evocative.
Let's use the thermostat analogy. Mm-hmm. A simple mechanical thermostat on your wall is a closure regime. When the room gets cold, the thermostat encounters the cold air, a relational fact is constituted, and the mental coil contracts, turning on the heat. It registers the fact.
Right.
But it doesn't feel cold. It doesn't have a subjective experience of suffering or shivering.
Right. It just mechanically reacts.
But you are not a simple thermostat. You are a nested hierarchy of billions of closures. When you encounter a drop in temperature, your body doesn't just mechanically react. Your nervous system is organized enough to model the encounter. You model the temperature drop, you model your body's reaction to it,
right,
and you encounter the vast remainder of information you can't process.
Right.
According to Dietz, the sheer organizational depth of that encounter is consciousness. Consciousness is what it feels like from the inside to be a massively complex closure regime constituting relational facts.
Oh, wow. Okay, I think I see the synthesis here. It's like Dietz is saying that Ravelli, as a physicist, is looking at the building of reality from the outside. Ravelli is holding the blueprints. He maps the architecture perfectly. Ravelli says, here are the steel girders of relational facts. Here are the bricks of quantum events. Here is how the structure holds together. But Dietz is coming along and saying, yes, Carlo, the blueprints are flawless. But consciousness is what it feels like to actually live inside that exact same building. Ravelli describes the exterior structure. Dietz describes its felt interior.
It's a brilliant synthesis of two fields that historically hate each other. It respects the hard mathematical physics without ignoring or dismissing the undeniable reality of subjective experience. It says that your consciousness is not an illusion, as some strict materialists claim, and it's not a separate mystical soul realm, as dualists claim. It is the highest level expression of the exact same relational grammar that governs the electron.
It bridges the gap between the cold, abstract math of quantum mechanics and your warm, messy, lived experience right now. You aren't separate from the quantum world. You aren't a ghost haunting a biological machine. Your conscious experience, your feeling of time passing, your perception of colors and sounds and love and pain, these are all the ultimate high-level expressions of the universe's relational rules playing out in real time.
It makes you profoundly, inextricably integrated into the cosmos. You are quite literally the universe relating to itself.
Which brings us to the end of our deep dive. I want to take a moment to pull all of this together because we have covered a staggering amount of conceptual ground today. We started with the realization that cutting-edge quantum physics and epistemology have independently discovered the same grammar of relations. We learned that the universe isn't a collection of isolated, independent things possessing absolute properties. Reality is an ongoing, dynamic conversation.
We learned that the world is made of events, not things. Facts are constituted entirely in temporary interactions, in handshakes.
We discovered that time itself doesn't flow independently in the background like a universal clock. The arrow of time emerges from the friction of our own ignorance, from our finite biological closure regimes encountering the infinite, inexhaustible remainder of the universe that we cannot process.
And we saw that there is no ultimate objective viewpoint from nowhere. The absolute view, the God's eye spreadsheet of reality, is a physical impossibility. Every perspective is partial and every fact is relational, right up to your own conscious subjective experience of the world.
Which, honestly, is incredibly relevant for how we live today. We live in an era of intense, overwhelming information overload. We are constantly searching for the ultimate objective truth. We scour the internet, we argue on social media, we look for the absolute certainty that will finally make us feel secure and tell us who is right and who is wrong.
But navigating this world gets a lot easier and a lot less anxiety-inducing when you realize you don't need to find absolute objective certainty because physically, structurally, it literally doesn't exist. It's a phantom pursuit.
You just need to understand the relationships and the perspectives at play. You need to understand how you, as a unique closure regime, with your unique history and identity criteria, are interacting with the world to constitute the facts of your own life. It's a massive shift from demanding what is the absolute truth of this situation to asking what is true relative to this specific interaction.
It fosters a deep intellectual humility. It forces you to recognize that your view of the world is entirely real, but is also permanently partial.
So we want to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over as you go about the rest of your day, a thought that builds on everything we've explored about relativity, events, and consciousness. If modern physics and philosophy agree that you do not possess any absolute inherent properties floating in a void,
and that every fact about you, every single thing that makes you you, your personality, your beliefs, your physical state, only exists in relation to what you interact with,
who exactly are you when you are completely isolated? If the universe is an endless web of relations, what happens to your reality when you stop reaching out? When you retreat inward and cut yourself off from the world, remember that tiny electron we started with? The one zooming through space? Without an interaction, it doesn't just have a hidden speed. It has no speed at all. It sits in a state of indefinite potential. It is a ghost. So if your reality is entirely relational, if your very existence is built on the grammar of handshakes, the most fundamental thing you can do to exist in this universe is to connect.
A profound thought to end on. We literally construct reality for each other.
Thanks for taking this deep dive with us. I hope it shifted your perspective, even just a little bit, relative to when you started listening. Until next time.